This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, April 6th, 2021, National Library Workers' Day. I'm Kyle Kellums. On our show today, the reasons the governor says he issued a veto for a bill banning transgender care for young Arkansans. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has that report. In our second half hour, the Middleton Grammarian is picking a few easily misspelled words and offering some ways to easily remember how to spell them correctly. After our hour, stay with 91.3 for a Tuesday here and now from NPR. Today, Black Americans are dying of COVID in higher numbers than whites. We talk with a pastor who's ministering to people in marginalized parts of the community. That's next time on Here and Now, beginning at 1, right after today's Ozarks at Large. Governor Asa Hutchinson is issuing a veto of House Bill 1570, legislation passed by the General Assembly that would ban gender reassignment surgeries and hormone prescriptions for Arkansans younger than 18. At a press conference yesterday, the governor described the bill as well-intentioned, but off course. The governor says if the bill becomes law, the state is creating new standards of legislative interference with physicians and parents as they deal with complex and sensitive matters involving young people. The bill passed overwhelmingly in both chambers and, with the same margins of success, the veto could be overridden by legislators. We'll have more about the veto and reaction later this hour. Arkansas is adding 44 newly diagnosed cases of COVID-19 after the last 24 hours of tests. Five more Arkansas deaths are being reported. Active cases in the state dropped by 122. There are now just over 1,600 cases as of yesterday afternoon. Southwestern Electric Power Company is offering long-term interest-free payment plans for Arkansas residents struggling to pay past due bills because of the pandemic. The company has announced a return to normal operations for disconnections on May 3rd as a state-imposed moratorium on disconnections expires. A press release from SWEPCO indicates the utility is willing to spend the cost of past due bills over 3 to 18-month periods. People interested in taking advantage of the plan can find out more information at the SWEPCO Facebook or Twitter pages or by calling 877-446-7211. The John Brown University women's soccer team is one win away from a spot in the NAIA National Championship Tournament. JBU shut out Oklahoma City 4-0 yesterday and will now host Science and Arts Thursday in Siloam Springs in the Sooner Athletic Conference Championship. The Arkansas Razorback baseball team, ranked first in the country, home tonight for a game against Little Rock, scheduled to begin at 6:30. The number 11 Razorback softball team, also home tonight, hosting Missouri State at 5. There is a 40% chance of rain overnight. Best chance for showers or thunderstorms after 4 a.m. Lows expected in the lower 60s. Tomorrow, 70% chance of rain throughout the day, with highs in the upper 60s in northwest Arkansas and lower 70s in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. New COVID-19 cases, as well as hospitalizations, have dropped significantly in Arkansas after setting records at the beginning of this year. For a detailed look at COVID-19 trends during March, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Mary Hennigan and Katie Sider from the University of Arkansas School of Journalism. Both are assistant editors of ArkansasCOVID.com, and Katie started their monthly conversation yesterday by discussing how their analysis has changed now that the number of new cases are more constant instead of experiencing sharp increases or decreases.
I think now that we're seeing kind of this steady trend, we're looking at more deeper analyses and like time analyses. So comparing, you know, March to a year ago, we just had the 1-year anniversary. So looking at the past year, looking at how this month compares to the wave we had over the holiday season. So we're looking at more in-depth reporting now.
So tell me a little bit more about some of the things that you've found in terms of cases and hospitalizations, kind of the typical things that we look at.
In March, we saw a significant decrease in new cases, like we just mentioned. On average, there were 257 cases per day in March for a total of 7,983 new cases in the month. That is only a third of the cases that were reported in February, and this was the lowest month we've seen since March in terms of cases. Deaths have been consistent with February. On average, there were 12 COVID deaths per day in March, and there was a total of 383 deaths reported in the month, which is a slight increase in monthly deaths compared to February.
And how did the demographics break down? Did the lower numbers impact that?
Yeah, so cases by racial demographic decreased significantly this month again, and all groups had an increase less than 5%. So when the numbers get this small, I can start to now look at the counts instead of percentage increases. So the white population had a count increase of less than 6,000, African Americans of about 1,200, and Hispanics with 780 new cases during this month. There were 42 Native American cases. They had a 4% increase, the highest of March. Deaths in March were also a lot lower than previous months, and that was reflected in all racial groups as well. The largest increase of the month was the addition of 69 new deaths in the African American group, which was a 9% increase. For comparison, the white population reported 284 deaths, a 7% increase during the month. The increase in the age groups were all pretty equal. There wasn't much variation, and the increases were significantly lower than the last few months. Percentage increases were 2% in all groups, except 65 plus, which had a 3% increase. Age deaths in March were more variable than they were last month in ages. Three age groups reported zero deaths, and the other ranged from 7 to 18% increase. The 35 to 44-year-olds had the highest percentage increase, with 15 new deaths for a total of 97 in that group. The eldest group, 65 plus, increased by 291, which was comparatively lower increase at 7%. And the March increases were down to one third of what they were in February for gender. Both males and females had a 3% increase during the month.
And with the cases being so low, part of that is probably due to vaccination. So I think a lot of focus now has turned from the number of cases and hospitalizations and things like that because they have been so steady, to more of a focus on vaccination efforts. So what did you find in those trends?
Statewide, Arkansas has received nearly 2 million doses, and 68% of those doses have been administered. So far, Cleveland, Franklin, and Dallas counties have the highest fully vaccinated populations in the state.
What other things should we know? What other trends stood out to you during the month of March?
Hospitalizations steadily decreased in March, like other things. The month ended with 166 patients statewide, and patients on ventilators had a similar decrease, ending with 27 patients statewide. Both of these were decreases of more than 60%, and these numbers were similar to those reported in early July. So as we mentioned, with the numbers now becoming smaller, we can make comparisons to earlier times during the pandemic.
And what has that been like for you, sort of switching your perspective a little bit from month to month to being able to compare it to a year ago?
I remember when I came onto Arkansas COVID last May, we were just getting into the summertime and things were really picking up. So having hospitalizations over 100 was a big deal. And now we are finally getting back to seeing those numbers that we had in July. A lot of the reporting has shifted to, you know, we have reached 150 hospitalizations and that being very substantial. And now it is finally, we're coming back down to these numbers. So at this point, we're now coming full circle in my reporting, at least.
That was University of Arkansas undergraduate student Mary Hennigan and graduate student Katie Sider. The journalism students and assistant editors of ArkansasCOVID.com spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda yesterday. More data analysis of the pandemic, as well as coverage of the state's vaccination efforts, are available at ArkansasCOVID.com. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson held a press conference yesterday to announce he is vetoing a bill passed by the Arkansas legislature, the first of its kind, to bar gender-affirming medical care for minors. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has more.
Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson says he spent the last week investigating the impact of Save Adolescents from Experimentation, or SAFE Act, if he were to sign it into law.
I was told this week that the nation is looking at Arkansas because I have on my desk another bill passed by the General Assembly that is a product of the cultural war in America. I don't shy away from the battle when it is necessary and defensible, but the most recent action of the General Assembly, while well-intended, is off course, and I must veto House Bill 1570.
Hutchinson has spent the last week meeting with transgender Arkansans, their families, activists, and medical providers to better understand.
It is undisputed that the population of minors who struggle with gender incongruity or gender dysphoria is an extreme minority. But while they are a minority, they deserve the guiding hand of their parents and of the healthcare professionals that their family has chosen.
He says approving the SAFE Act will set a bad precedent for the nation.
House Bill 1570 would put the state as the definitive oracle of medical care, overriding parents, patients, and healthcare experts. While in some instances the state must act to protect life, the state should not presume to jump into the middle of every medical, human, and ethical issue. This would be and is a vast government overreach.
Hutchinson says the law could cause real harm to Arkansas trans youth. He learned number around 200.
House Bill 1570 is opposed by the leading Arkansas medical associations, and the concern expressed is that denying best medical care to transgender youth can lead to significant harm to the young person, from suicidal tendencies and social isolation to increased drug use.
The governor says he's learned from medical providers that the scope of gender-affirming care for minors compared to adults who may seek gender reassignment surgery is limited by state medical practitioners.
In Arkansas, gender reassignment surgery is not performed on anyone under age 18. If House Bill 1570 simply prohibited gender reassignment surgeries, then I would sign the bill. But the bill is overbroad, extreme, and does not grandfather those young people who are currently under hormone treatment. In other words, the young people who are currently under a doctor's care will be without treatment when this law goes into effect. That means they will be looking to the black market or go out of state, if they can afford it, to find the treatment that they want and need. This is not the right path to put them on.
Hutchinson told reporters he's met with lead lawmakers who support the SAFE Act, asking them to not override his veto.
House Bill 1570 had overwhelming support when it passed the first time, and as you know, it takes a simple majority to override the governor's veto in Arkansas. I'm hopeful, though, that my action will cause conservative Republican legislators to think through the issue again and hopefully come up with a more restrained approach that allows a thoughtful study of the science and ethics surrounding the issue before acting. Government, under a conservative philosophy, should be restrained. This is an example of where restraint is better than overbroad actions that interfere with important relationships in our society.
To override the proposed law, 51 members of the Arkansas House and 18 members of the Arkansas Senate will have to vote to enact. Holly Dixon, executive director of the ACLU Arkansas, says she's grateful for the governor's veto.
And recognize that gender-affirming care is also life-saving care for trans youth.
Dixon says she's hopeful legislators will also take time to research the evidence supporting transgender-affirming medical care for minors.
If that does not happen, we remain committed to doing everything we can to stop this law from going into effect, including going to court if that's what legislators force these families to do to protect their children.
Starting hormones was life-changing for me, and I probably wouldn't be where I am today if I had not done so.
At a press conference at the state capitol over the weekend, 18-year-old Willow Brashears, a trans woman and activist who lives in Little Rock, says gender-affirming medical care saved her life.
I transitioned and started hormones at the age of 13. I know firsthand the importance of having competent doctors who support you in your transition. Being able to medically transition at a young age allowed me to be the truest version of myself.
Brashear says the SAFE Act is not about protecting children, as lawmakers claim.
While legislators attempt to block access to this care for trans youth, it's important to fight for these kids and the kids to come after them. We will not tolerate this hate, and we'll call it what it is, hate. Arkansas doesn't want to see trans kids live openly, and this legislation is furthering the message that every trans kid is taught very early in their transition. We are different, and people don't like that. Despite these messages being told to us, I always come back to this mantra. Trans people are beautiful, trans people are sacred, and trans people are powerful.
According to the Williams Institute, based at the UCLA School of Law, 1.4 million adults identify as transgender. Trans youth ages 13 to 17 number less than 150,000, based on demographic surveys. The American Medical Association and other major national healthcare groups support transgender-affirming medical care so that Americans, they say, can live in accordance with their gender identity. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can share stories you hear on Ozarks at Large by using links associated with the stories at ozarksatlarge.com. And you can keep up with what's happening by subscribing to our Ozarks at Large email newsletter. We send it each Monday through Friday afternoon for free to you with the news of the day, links to stories and interviews on our show, and much more. It's free and available at KUAF.com/newsletter. And in case you missed Jacqueline Froelich's coverage of this very matter on NPR's All Things Considered yesterday or Morning Edition this morning, you can search NPR.org. The Cherokee Nation and Oklahoma Air National Guard broke ground yesterday at the future site of 21 new homes for eligible Cherokee veterans and their families. The project is part of the Cherokee Veterans Housing Initiative through the U.S. Department of Defense Innovative Readiness Training Program. Plans include a total of 21 new homes over the next 3 years, with the first 7 new single-family subsidized homes to be built in the first year, along with the necessary infrastructure to support the housing addition. And Opera in the Ozarks is returning. The 70th season is scheduled to begin in July. The 2021 season carries the title of Tying the Knot and will run from July 2nd through the 23rd. There will be 35 singers and 19 orchestra members in Eureka Springs to present 19 staged and costume operas. Though the Opera in the Ozarks companies of recent years have presented programs away from Eureka, this year's season will be solely at Inspiration Point. Seating will be limited. Masks and face coverings will be required. Among the works presented this year, Mozart's The Magic Flute.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by American Shaman Kava Bar, featuring local craft beers and organic kava drinks in a family-friendly atmosphere. Coming soon, the Shaman Rec Room, offering ping pong, pool, and darts. Inspired and designed by locals in downtown Fayetteville. AmericanShamanKavaBar.com for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on an early April Tuesday. A quarter of a century after bald eagles, which were considered an endangered species at the time, began dying at lakes near Hot Springs, researchers finally have a more complete picture of what caused the deaths of more than 70 of the birds. We now know the eagles died because of a specific algae that lives on a specific invasive water plant and makes a novel toxin, but only in the presence of specific pollutants. As Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us, researchers who have been chipping away at the mystery for years have finally identified that specific pollutant as bromide.
In the mid-1990s, dozens of bald eagles started dying around a Gray Lake.
The Gray Lake is a 13,400-acre Corps of Engineers reservoir.
That's Sean Lusk. He's a fisheries management biologist at the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission.
It's located about 30 minutes south of Hot Springs, just a little north of Arkadelphia. It's relatively unproductive, so there's not a lot of nutrients that come into the lake. And because of that, the water's really clear, which attracts a lot of recreational boaters. The Gray's got a really diverse fishery. It's kind of unique for this part of the world.
One of Lusk's colleagues at the agency is Jennifer Ballard. She's the state wildlife veterinarian and assistant chief of the research division at AGFC.
It's kind of an interesting case study that's used in training wildlife veterinarians. So I remember studying it in school and being in Native Arkansan, I remember it happening. So what essentially happened is there were these fairly sudden reports in the winter of coots that behaved abnormally, and also sick eagles that had neurologic signs. So they didn't have a normal behavior, normal posture.
According to reports, the birds were flying into cliffs and trees. Their wings drooped and they stumbled around on the ground. Over the course of several years, more than 70 eagles were found dead, mostly at DeGray Lake. Ballard says the University of Georgia, which has the oldest wildlife disease research facilities in the country, stepped in to help with the investigation, which they were able to narrow down to the cyanobacteria, or blue-green algae, that liked growing on an invasive plant called hydrilla.
They kind of narrowed it down that the coots were eating the plant with the cyanobacterium on it. They were being exposed to an unknown toxin, and when it affected them and they behaved abnormally, they became easy prey for the eagles who were consuming them. And when they consumed them, they started demonstrating the same signs.
The hydrilla eventually disappeared from the landscape for reasons we'll get into later. But researchers at the University of Georgia continued investigating the eagle mortalities.
They finally, after all these years, did this brilliant piece of sort of collaborative interdisciplinary research, genetics and an amazing amount of biochemistry to isolate the toxin. And they have identified the toxin. They have found that bromide in the environment contributes to the toxin being produced.
The toxin that then leads to brain lesions that lead to the symptoms displayed by the eagles at DeGray Lake. The results of this two decades of research were published in the March 26th issue of Science magazine. Susan Wild, who is an associate professor of aquatic science at the University of Georgia, is one of the co-authors of the study titled Hunting the Eagle Killer.
My research focuses on primarily impaired aquatic systems, like triage ecology.
Wild says she didn't learn of the eagle mortality event at DeGray Lake until 2001, when eagles started dying in a similar fashion at a lake in South Carolina.
And one of the things I learned a lot from was the public television show Saving the Eagles that they put it out in 1998, I believe. And you can see the conclusion to that they're just like, well, we think it's probably a toxin, but we just don't know yet. So that helped me to see what the site looked like, what the investigators were considering, what had been excluded.
While researchers didn't know what the toxin was just yet, the information they had at the time did conclusively diagnose the disease as a new phenomenon in eagles.
So that's a pretty important clue that it was something novel on the landscape that caused this, most likely.
The cause of the eagle deaths was referred to as avian vacular myelinopathy. Although researchers now know that fish and other wildlife are also susceptible to the toxin that causes AVM and creates holes in the brains and spinal cords of affected animals. Wild says so far the toxin has only been found in man-made reservoirs in the southeast.
Often those reservoirs will be open habitat for an invasive species to come in and set up shop. And hydrilla just became so dense in so many systems across the southeast.
That includes the system at DeGray Lake. Wild says the hydrilla creates surface area for the blue-green algae to grow on. It also creates an attractive habitat for migratory birds like coots. Eagles and other predatory birds move in after that when they notice an abundance of prey that's become disoriented by a neurotoxin.
You know, it's called an ecological trap. When you have habitat that appears to be very good habitat, but is in fact, they're not able to reproduce, and it might even be fatal to them. So a fatal attraction.
As Wild and her team discovered, one of the key components of the fatal attraction in the case of DeGray Lake and others like it was bromide.
And it turns out that in plants, some of them, and in particular hydrilla, can hyperaccumulate, can actually take up more bromide than the sediment has. So they're actually a great source of bromide, which is where the cyanobacteria are growing. So that was like the final molecule they needed to build the toxin. And then they're the ones that make it.
but only in the presence of sufficient amounts of this bromide.
While there are naturally occurring instances of bromide, humans have added a lot more of it into ecosystems through activities like coal mining, water treatment, and driving, which creates exhaust. Wild says part of her research journey included sequencing the DNA of the cyanobacteria she was examining, which led to the discovery of a new species.
But it took me another 10 years to even name the officially name the cyanobacteria, and then a longer still to be able to isolate the fraction from that plant cyanobacterial complex that was actually toxic.
It would take several more years before Wild was able to identify bromide as the culprit. She started by sending her samples to researchers in Germany who specialize in molecules made by cyanobacteria. It then took 2 years to grow enough cyanobacteria for Wild to test in chickens.
And it was negative. We had no sick chickens. We had no lesions. And so it wasn't until the second time growing it up in the presence of bromide that it was producing the toxin. And then when we tested it on chickens, yes, they did get sick.
The German researchers concluded bromide played a role in the production of the toxin after finding a novel molecule in the cyanobacteria growing on the hydrilla. The molecule was unlike anything they've seen before and contained 5 atoms of bromine. Another group of collaborators confirmed the team's work further when it found the cyanobacteria genes likely responsible for synthesizing the toxin. And while the hydrilla at DeGray Lake is long gone, which means the cyanobacteria is too, Wild says having more information about the event makes wildlife managers better equipped for the future.
I guess we had to take it all the way to the final endpoint for people to be convinced that this hypothesis was not just, you know, a probable cause, but it was the cause. And therefore, we do know what the solution is.
But several unanswered questions remain.
So for us, it's really interesting because we're wondering, what's the major source of this bromide?
That's fisheries management biologist Sean Lusk again.
What is the source of this bromide on other lakes? Because, you know, it wasn't just Washtenaw and DeGray where this was happening. I believe there was a lake in Texas and there was a couple lakes out east. So for me, it would be interesting to see what's that common denominator? What do these lakes all have in common? And what's the source of that bromide?
Lusk says that information could be valuable should the hydrilla ever make a comeback on DeGray Lake. For now, though, the reservoir isn't much of a home to hydrilla or any other aquatic plants. After several years of fluctuating lake levels, from near-record lows to near-record highs, led to a dramatic decline in vegetation. A problem Lusk is now working to solve.
The vegetation really hasn't rebounded very much. So a couple years ago, we started trying to reestablish aquatic vegetation on the Gray Lake. We're working with four different species right now: coontail, eelgrass, American pondweed, and sago pondweed. And those are all native species. And we're trying to focus all of our areas on, or all of our vegetation work on, areas that have the potential to have the most impact on the lake.
Arkansas Game and Fish veterinarian Jennifer Ballard says the information published by Susan Wild and her team is also essential to the agency's ongoing monitoring of eagle health in the state.
We have an ongoing eagle health research project. We continue to watch for this, for similar mortalities to occur. We don't want them to come back. So, and understanding now this bromide component, it really has application that we'll be able to watch, you know, bromide levels in the lake if we need to, and if we need to adjust some of the chemicals that are used to control that vegetation.
Ballard says discussions have already begun about the ways AGFC could figure out where the high levels of bromide came from. And while the toxin has only been identified at a handful of lakes in the southeast, Susan Wild says it's possible it's killing wildlife elsewhere in places where humans haven't detected it yet.
Because unless an eagle is there in a territory that's established and you notice a bird like that goes missing or you find dead and people truly notice it, I think it can slide under the radar.
Wild says that's particularly worrisome as invasive aquatic plants like hydrilla continue to spread across the U.S. and Canada.
And we don't know if the cyanobacteria could be growing on those plants in more locations than we have been able to screen. So we are trying to increase our monitoring and the extent to which we're able to monitor.
One of the easiest and most cost-effective ways of doing that, Wild says, is to partner with reservoir managers who can ship samples of their plants to the University of Georgia.
That is actually the only way I've gotten to look at the Arkansas plants is by having had them sent to me.
Wild also recommends boaters get better acquainted with the vegetation around them, because invasive plants like hydrilla can reproduce from fragments left behind on a boat that's getting moved between waterways.
Just like with everything else, unfortunately, we need to be really mindful about what we're moving around between reservoirs, and just know how to recognize if you are in a location that has the invasive plants.
Locations with invasive plants can be reported to state and national agencies like the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission and the U.S. Geological Survey, or submitted via a smartphone app like iNaturalist.
So it really does help if people recognize species that aren't supposed to be there and report it. That helps us a lot.
And Jennifer Ballard adds, the AGFC also wants to hear from people who come across sick or dead eagles or any other wildlife, as it could be a sign of a problem in their ecosystem. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
The bald eagle population in the United States has rebounded significantly since Wild started her research in 2001. The bird was removed from the endangered species list in 2007. And last month, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced the number of eagles in the contiguous 48 states has quadrupled since 2009 to more than 315,000 individual birds.
KUAF is supported by Dr. Kathleen Wong, providing in-office ketamine infusion therapy for treatment of depression and anxiety disorders. Following NIMH protocol, ketamine therapy is an effective alternative when other treatments fail. Located in Fayetteville, 935-9707 or drwongketamine.com for more information. The 45th annual Hogeye Marathon is Saturday, April 24th and 25th in downtown Springdale. This full and half marathon, 5K and 10K run, plus four-person marathon relay will benefit several local charities. Finisher medals will be awarded. The online registration deadline is April 22nd. HogeyeMarathon.com for information.
The Arkansas General Assembly is staying busy. There is the possible override of Governor Hutchinson's veto of House Bill 1570. There is consideration of an adapted bill addressing hate crimes and consideration of the state declaring autonomy when it comes to laws regarding firearms. The legislature is the focus of this week's conversation between Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics and John Brummett, political columnist with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. John Brummett first offers an examination of the modified hate crimes legislation.
It's hate crimes without calling itself a hate crimes bill. It's a magic piece of legislation in that at once it manages to continue the hatefulness of this legislative session. But if adopted, I think it would do some good and maybe even as much as traditional hate crime legislation calling itself a hate crime would do. It simply takes out any specific references to victims as part of named groups which offended the right wing, be it race, sexual identity, sexual preference or orientation, gender identity. And the business community is behind it. The governor is all for it. With all due respect, I think mainly their motivation is they don't want Arkansas to continue to be conspicuous as one of two or three states without such a law. They want something they can call a law. Their lawyers tell them this would do pretty much what traditional hate crimes phrasing would do. But the fact that to pass it, specific mention by race, sexual orientation, gender identity, is taken out, that offends the liberal side, the Democratic side, the Black caucus. So now the governor and the business leaders are thinking they might be able to pass it, but they're worried they might pass it with only Republican votes, which would do them no good in terms of the state's national image. So it's sort of a remarkable dynamic. But to me, the story is, will any Democrats say, you know, I hate that we're going to do it this way, but it would do some good. Will they get any Democrats to vote for it? That's the big question for me.
Yeah, you've outlined the political dynamics there. Can they get the Democrats to support something not called hate crimes legislation, but does kind of what it is expected to do? And can they get enough Republican votes to do it? I mean, I think there's still a big rift in the Republican.
There is, but the, yeah,
jeopardizing the 51. So
there is, but there is general thought that the Senate's ready to pass it with just Republicans. If that's necessary, House not any vote counting there. Even though it's not done. I do think a deal has been made among the extreme right wingers on the Judiciary Committee who blocked this whole thing in the first place because they didn't like the supposed special treatment of gays, transgenders, or that sort of thing. I think they have compromised to this extent. They're saying, okay, we'll let it out of committee. I think that's what we're going to see. And a better chance of passage in the Senate, uncertain in the House. And the big question, is it Republicans only? In which case, if there are national headlines to come, they will be Republicans who blocked a real hate crimes bill have passed a version in Arkansas. That's not the headline the governor and the business leadership of the state.
You wrote a column over the weekend about fear and this legislative session. I want you to kind of give everybody a recap of what that column was about. And,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Last week, the state Senate, by a vote of 28-7, passed a bill that presumes to say, we're sovereign in Arkansas on federal gun laws. We don't have to abide by them. And we're going to let our local law enforcement people be the judges of whether we'll work with federal authorities or enforce these federal gun laws, either the ones we have now or prospective ones. And in the course of it, a couple of senators, principally Terry Rice, gave an impassioned appeal for support for the bill because he seemed genuinely to believe that Biden and the Democrats in Congress are working and coming for everybody's guns. And the bill simply asserts sovereignty against federal gun laws for the state of Arkansas. That obviously, it almost goes without saying, that obviously violates the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution and will be thrown out. Just like the Civil War was lost and Little Rock and troops were sent to Little Rock to enforce the law in 1957, if the bill should become law. But I analyzed it as a matter of that fear that Terry Rice explained. And Joyce Elliott, Senator, Liberal Democratic Senator, was telling me she wants to talk to these conservative colleagues. She wants to sit down and find out why they seem really earnestly to believe that their guns are going to get taken. Anything they're considering in the Congress or proposed by the Biden administration is prospectively for background checks or for assault weapon ban on sales forthcoming. There's not going to be gun confiscation in this country, but there are those who think so. So that's the way I analyzed it. One little additional thing. What happens on these bills is that you've got a half dozen or so in the Senate, let's say, sort of unsophisticated, primitive thinkers. Forgive me for saying that. But they truly believe that they should do this and can do it. Then you've got a whole bevy of normal conservative senators who know the bill is not valid, but they're afraid to vote against it because they'll get primaried. And that's where we are.
John Brummett is a political columnist with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock is with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. There is more from their conversation online at talkbusiness.net.
Shannon Servaas is a chemical engineering professor at the University of Arkansas, and for the past year, she's worked with Now Diagnostics in Springdale to develop a rapid test kit to detect the coronavirus.
We started looking at the technology I was developing for influenza to consider whether it could be transferred to this new virus that we didn't even have a name for at the time. And that didn't really seem possible. So we kind of set that aside. And then in February, it hit in Italy, and that hit close to home for Now Diagnostics because that's where their European headquarters are. And so when they were getting hit the hardest in Italy, we realized we have to do something.
In the latest edition of Short Talks from the Hill, a research podcast of the University of Arkansas, Servaas discusses her work and submitting an emergency use authorization to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and how the rapid test kit is currently under consideration. You can find Short Talks from the Hill under the On Air and Podcast link at KUAF.com or at researchfrontiers.uark.edu.
This is Ozarks at Large. We are on Eastwood Avenue, Eastwood Drive. I think it's an avenue. I've only lived here 10 years. I should know what that is.
I think it's Drive. I don't know.
I think you're right. I think it's Eastwood Drive on Mount Sequoia on my front porch with Catherine Shirls, the militant grammarian. We're hoping this is our last session of recordings that we have to do outside of the studio. Wear your mask until you don't have to, right?
Right.
Okay.
Even if you're, I'm 2 days away from being totally immunized or as much as you can get these days.
But you're still being careful.
Oh, Lord.
For everybody else,
I even double mask when I go in a store.
There you go. Mm-hmm. What do we got today?
Spell check aside, Kyle, are there any words that you always have to look up for spelling?
We don't have time.
Well, and you speak them, so as long as you can.
Yes, but I also write for other people, and occasionally it has somewhere between 2 and 9 C's and as many L's. There are so many. For years, I couldn't, for whatever reason, I couldn't remember if sheriff had 2 R's, 1 F, 2 F's, 1 R.
Mm-hmm. And then you get bailiff, and I think it's totally different.
Right.
And plaintiff, and, you know, it's different.
Though. So, yes, there are many.
Yeah. Well, mine is label. It doesn't make sense to me that the final two letters are as they are, E-L.
Yeah, I see that. I get you.
Not like cable.
Right.
Fable, gable, sable, or table, which end in L-E.
I mean, if it's lapel, it should be label.
Yeah, right. I didn't think of lapel. And that makes sense to me as E-L, yeah. And when I finally learned to spell label E-L, I started second-guessing myself about nickel.
Oh, yeah, I get you.
I'm still in E-L hell. So here are 10 commonly misspelled words from Word Genius. Let's see how you do. Do you want
Isn't the pandemic enough that we have to spell? No, paper
okay,
wouldn't
you're
help.
Go without
yes.
paper. Okay. How do you spell separate?
SEPARATE.
Right. I tried to teach my students the old mnemonic device. There's a rat in separate.
Yep.
Doesn't sound like there's a rat in there.
Right.
But the phrase helps people remember.
When I spell it, I pronounce it differently.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and I still pronounce together to get her when I spell it.
Yes, absolutely.
And Wednesday.
Yep.
I saw a meme not too long ago on Facebook. Somebody else said Wednesday.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the same vein, many people have trouble with desperate, which, while sounding very similar to separate, the vowels sound as if they actually belong there.
Right.
Okay, how about embarrass?
E-M-B-A-R-R-A-S-S?
Yes, that's right.
Whew.
One memory aid that might help is to remember that embarrassment is usually not a singular experience, so you think of doubling up.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
There are 2 R's and 2 S's. Double the letters and double the pain. I learned it in my journalism classes eons ago when we had to learn to spell back then.
Yeah.
For some reason, I had retained the double letters in embarrass as well as the fact that harass doesn't double the R's.
That's right.
Okay, Kyle, spell liaison.
Ooh, this is the one of this is okay. This is one of the ones I always have to look up. Liaison, L I A I S O N.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
That's right.
Ooh.
So that I, that second I, is silent.
Uh-huh.
And it's just waiting to be forgotten or misplaced.
That's what I do.
Yeah. I had to look this one up because until now, I pronounced the second I. I said liaison.
I've heard that often, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, well, you know, that's kind of like the words often and salmon.
Mm-hmm.
There are words that you're supposed to ignore.
Yeah, letters, you mean? Or,
yeah, I mean letters. Yeah, letters, right.
You know, the
T in often shouldn't be pronounced.
Although the last time I looked up Webster's, I mean, not the online, but the one with a binding and pages, they said often was okay.
We're going to talk about that later, about battles I've lost.
All right.
Okay, Cal, how do you spell guarantee?
G-U-A-R-A-N-T-E-E? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Two E's at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the question is, if guacamole has a gua
right
at the start, why don't we say guarantee?
Well, I'm going to guess that they have two different geographic origins.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. I mean, you know, and the question is, why do you ever question English language?
Exactly. You know? This hybrid of everything.
Now, this one is a spell check nightmare. Spell definitely.
Oh. All right. D-E-F-I-N-T-L-E. All right, D-E-F-I-N. Yeah, what's that vowel there?
That's the one people mess up.
Is it an E-L-A? I? It's not
Y?
You.
Why, you? No. The way I remember, mm-hmm. it is, has finite
oh.
in it.
Well,
so
there you
spell
go.
It now.
D-E-F-I-N-I-T-E-L-Y.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that now.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
I think of it every time. Everyone wants to drop an A somewhere in the word because
yes.
we tend to pronounce the second syllable as fa instead of
yes.
that fin.
Now, had I been writing that down, I would have known that was wrong.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't have looked right.
Right. I looked for the word finite. And as I said, and it helps me remember,
oh,
spell
okay.
check has led to my reading some pretty funny sentences in my students' papers. And they are not showing passion when they write, "I am defiantly opposed to online learning." Now, these days they might
yes, exactly.
mean defiantly
That's
as opposed
true.
To definitely. But they won't put that A in there. Vacuum.
It's two U's. The question is C's. And I think when I write it down... Two C's doesn't look right. So V-A-C-U-U-M?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's People are often stumped by which letter repeats, the C, the U, the M.
Oh, yeah.
You and I had this discussion last summer, and we were both surprised to find that continuum also has double U's.
Yeah. It still doesn't seem right, does it?
I've seen a lot of folks tripped up by this one. Accommodate.
A-C-C-O-M-M-A-D-A-T-E?
A comma. Yeah, it sounds like comma, but it's not.
Oh. Oh?
No.
Yeah, again, yeah. if I'm writing these down, I think
accommodation.
That, yeah.
Yeah, of course, we yeah. don't say accommodate. We say right. accommodate. It sounds like an A, sure.
Right.
But that's not the letter I expected you to miss. I expected you to miss one of the doubles.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, got the doubles.
Double consonants can be tough to remember, much less two sets. People also sometimes add an A.
Yeah.
Instead of the second O. Bob Douglas, former Arkansas Gazette editor and journalism department chair, used to tell his students, never stay at a hotel whose sign misspells accommodations.
Good point. Good point.
That may be why I remember it so well. Recommend.
Oh, we got some doubles here.
Mm-hmm.
R-E-C-C-O-M-M-E-N-D.
Mm-mm.
Ah! I was doing so well at the beginning of this. R-E-C-O-M-M-E-N-D?
Mm-hmm.
One
right.
C.
Mm-hmm. Mm. As a mirror to accommodate, recommend stands out because it's missing that double consonant that seems so logical. Some people can grow this vegetable easier than they can spell it.
Uh-oh.
Zucchini.
C-U-C-U-M-B-E-R.
What?
I spelled cucumber. zucchini. Z-U-C-C-H-I-N-I.
Very good.
Yeah, I can't get recommend, but I get zucchini. It makes a lot of sense.
Because you use zucchini so much
exactly.
more often than you do recommend.
Exactly.
Because it's Italian in origin, zucchini doesn't follow the typical rules of English language. The double C and rhythmic I-N-I make it one to look up or trust your spell check.
Yes.
Oddly enough, Kyle, even after a year, I have to look up how to spell the breed of one of my adopted dogs. She's a docker, which is a cross between a Cocker Spaniel and, here we go, a long-haired dachshund.
Okay.
The worst part is I don't get even close enough for spell check to figure out what I'm trying to
happens.
Spell. The choices it offers include deckhand, dashed, and discount.
That's what, yes.
Wiener dog is a good substitute.
There you go.
But how do you spell wiener?
I'm looking in my head at the Arkansas map, Northeast Arkansas. W-I-E-N-E-R?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be positive that Wiener spelled it like the Wiener dog. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
Meat, but I guess it does. Okay. I'm
Milton Kramerian, and that's with two M's, is Catherine Sherrills. This is Ozarks at Large. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Sherry Ottaviano, Membership Director at KUAF. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
We're going to announce a winner of that we do every month, a KUAF contributor who's in good standing. We give them something. But before we do that, we are in good standing because of the spring fundraiser.
That's exactly right. We met our goal and a little bit more, and we owe a big thanks to all of our supporters, our listeners, who the first-time contributors and sustaining members who gave a little extra, and just everybody who pitched in to make sure we met our goal.
The last figure I had was $121,578.
That's correct.
Well done, folks, and thank you. All right, now we're going to give back something to one of those contributors.
That's correct. Anybody who donated, whether it's through a sustaining membership or a one-time gift during the month of March and the first 2 days in April, we drew a name randomly out of that group. And I'm proud to say that Lisa Ferguson out of Bella Vista, Arkansas, is going to receive a gift card to Mockingbird Kitchen for dinner and a couple of movie passes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for contributing. We're going to do this again in May, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Sherry Ottaviano is KUAF's Membership Director. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you, Kyle.
This is KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. The staff of KUAF Public Radio, as well as the entire KUAF listening audience, thanks everyone who donated during last week's spring on-air fundraiser on 91.3. With your effort and the hundreds of others who chipped in as well, we reached and surpassed our goal of $120,000. In fact, last Friday was KUAF's greatest single day of fundraising in its entire history. You helped us raise $52,000 on Friday, a truly incredible achievement. Remember, these fundraisers provide KUAF with the vital funding to keep the programs you listen to on the air. If you did not have the chance to give a gift last week, just go to KUAF.com and make your sustaining membership donation now. And thanks.
And indeed, thank you for your support of Public Radio, KUAF, and Ozarks at Large. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Muldrow Lake. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. The phone number that we mentioned earlier this hour for people struggling to pay SWEPCO bills because of the pandemic is 877-446-7211. You can also find out more information at SWEPCO's Facebook and Twitter pages. Contributors to our Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, and Susanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis produced today's program inside the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. Our militant grammarian is Catherine Sherrills. Our conversations between Roby Brock from Our Partner Talk Business and Politics and John Brummett, political columnist with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, come to us through our relationship with Talk Business and Politics. And thank you to Sherry Ottaviano, KUAF's Membership Director, for coming by to the program today as well. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. You can always find us at ozarksatlarge.com. You can subscribe to our free daily podcast through all the major podcast distributors. Thanks for listening. We return with another brand new show tomorrow.